today's episode of Fangirls, we welcome Deputy Culture Editor of The Guardian and author of the forthcoming book, Who Killed Davy Brown? Welcome, Stephanie Convery.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It is lovely. Now, you come from a self-described footy-mad family, though you're not a footy head yourself these days, and we're not really going to be talking to you too much about your fandom. Is that an apt description of where you're at with football?
That is correct. My brothers, I have four brothers and a very footy mad father, and they're all extremely big Collingwood fans. And I have been going for Collingwood my entire life, but I haven't been following the football for a while now. But we also have a very strong local footy family. Community. My dad is the president of the Elsternwick Football Club. So.
I love that.
Yeah.
We should get him on the pod.
Yeah.
Or he'd talk your ear off.
I feel like there's going to be a follow-up to this.
Yeah.
About all about that. Luckily, though, we haven't come here to talk to you about your footy fandom, but your work writing about concussion, a topic that's dominated sports headlines in Australia this year and will no doubt continue to following the landmark finding this week in which the degenerative brain disease CTE, or colloquially known as punch drunk, has been found in the brains of two rugby league players for the first time. So this is really relevant to what you've been writing about for the past couple of years of your life. So I thought maybe we could start with you telling us a little bit about your forthcoming book and what it explores.
Yeah, cool. So Who Killed Davy Brown is an investigation into the death of a Sydney boxer in 2015. So Davy Brown was a professional. He wasn't a world title, like a world champion or anything like that, but he was kind of on his way up, you know, like he was fighting for regional titles. He had an almost perfect professional record. He was very, very good. And he was trying to kind of get himself up into a level where he could fight for a world title and therefore kind of hit the big time. Now, he died after being knocked out in the final round of a title fight on the 11th of September 2015. There was an inquest into his death in 2017 in which the coroner found that he had died as a consequence of acute subdural hematoma, which is like a bleed on the brain, but that was the consequence of the final punch in the fight. Now, the reason he was knocked out in the fight in the final round was partly due to the fact that in the 11th round of the fight, so there was a 12th round of the fight that he was knocked out, in the 11th round of the fight he was concussed. And nobody who had responsibility for his safety during the fight stopped the fight, mm-hmm. It checked him out for concussion, or basically did anything to kind of address his health and safety. Like, they didn't even look at it. Mm. And that was one of the key issues in the inquest into his death. Like, did the people who were there know what concussion looked like and what the symptoms were? Did they try to identify it? Did they try to see if he was okay? So he was wobbling around the ring. He'd been knocked down twice. He got up and went through an eight count. At the end of that 11th round, he kind of stumbled back to his corner. His corner were clearly worried. They did a lot of things like that are in boxing. One of the things you can do is stall. They're stalling tactics, basically. So they poured water all over the floor. They ripped tape on his glove. These are all things that should stop a fight and give their fighter more time to recover.
Right.
So they recognised that something was wrong, and there were a lot of people in the audience that night. There were hundreds of people in this RSL where this fight took place who really didn't think he should be coming out for the final round. And a lot of the testimonies that were collected by the police later basically said, I can't believe they let him out for the final round. But they did, and he was late coming out, and he was stumbling around, and he wasn't holding his hands up properly. He barely even threw a punch. And there were some, 16 unreturned punches before the final one that knocked him out. And he never regained consciousness and died 3 days later. Yeah. So it was a really intense, incident. And what it kind of brought out of the inquest in particular brought out was just how little people in the sporting community, at least in the boxing community, but I do believe that this is a much bigger problem throughout professional sports in Australia, that how little people understand what concussion is, how it manifests, what the dangers of it are, and also how to identify it not only in other people but in themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really serious issue for sports people, like practitioners, and for the people that have a responsibility towards their safety. So part of what I did in the book that I'm writing at the moment, which will be out in March through Penguin Random House.
Good.
Part of what I did was investigate that. So what is concussion? How does it manifest? How do you tell if you have it or if somebody else has it? but also what are the long-term implications of it? So as I'm sure we'll talk about, one of the things that has been coming up in the news repeatedly over the last few years is the long-term impact of brain trauma. So CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but also like other forms of long-term repercussions from head injuries like concussion that sometimes manifest for some people and sometimes don't. And so one of the other things that happened while I was researching this book is that I've been boxing since 2014, I took this up before Davey died, before even knowing anything about him. When I was still living in Melbourne, I live in Sydney at the moment, partly because I had messed up my knee running, and my physio told me that boxing might be something that I could do that wouldn't hurt my knee too much. And I really loved it. And even getting hit in the head repeatedly was one of the things that kind of kept me coming back to it, like the adrenaline from it. Wow. And
I can't even
really
imagine
intense.
What that feels like.
Yeah. I don't think I'd like it.
It is. What's one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is explain why people box, but also why people kind of participate in sports that are very, very violent, implicitly or explicitly. So a sport like boxing makes explicit what other sports have implicitly in them, which is a lot of contact, a lot of kind of hard hits. I mean, like, which you guys talk a lot about AFL, there's like tackles, there's like bumps and, you know, all sorts of impact. So contact sports in general have an element of this. Just boxing kind of brings it really, makes it really explicit, brings it to the forefront, you know. You are literally punching each other in the head rather than just kind of...
To win.
Exactly. So I was really into this sport, and then I heard about Davey's death, and I was trying to write something about sport at the time, and I thought, okay, well... This feels really close to home, even though I don't know this guy and I don't really know that much about the circumstances of it, other than he was in a title fight. So that was one of the reasons why I started kind of digging into it and digging into what it. I mean, because one of the things people talk about in boxing is people who aren't boxers and people who aren't in the boxing community will say, "Oh, don't box, you're going to get brain damage." Everybody kind of knows that, right? Mm-hmm. It's this sort of cultural understanding that boxing is bad for your brain. Uh-huh. People would say that to me when I said I was a boxer. But when you're actually boxing, nobody talks about it. Nobody talks about brain injury. Nobody talks about concussion. Nobody talks about the long-term impact. So if somebody dies, one of the things that you kind of hear is, oh, it's just one of those things. Like, that's a
is
really...
Is it though?
Yeah, is it?
This doesn't happen to, like, you know, bowls players.
No. And that really kind of... got up my nose, right? Like, actually, I felt like this is something we should be talking about. Like, why are people dying? If they're dying because of an accident, or they're dying because that is an integral part, like that is the inevitable consequence of punching each other in the head. We should be acknowledging that this happens, and this is a dangerous sport. It's not just kind of a fun sort of rough and tumble kind of thing. It's actually we're playing with danger. So that's one side of it, but. As I was working on the book about Davey, I actually sustained a really serious concussion. In fact, I've been concussed 3 times in the last 2.5 years. But this one, I can talk about how it felt for me. But one of the things that happened was it ended up in like a long period of tests and consultations with doctors, and there was a suggestion that I might have long term kind of. Not brain injury, but that I had abnormalities in my brain.
Was this after the third one? Or
this is after the first one.
The first one.
Yeah. So I went through this period of about 3 months, and I can talk about it in a bit more detail if you like later. But basically, I was around the time of the inquest into Davey's death. I was dealing with the possible long-term consequences of brain injury, and it really kind of put the whole thing in perspective for me. It's like, this is not. Particularly when the outcome of the inquest was that there were so many people who didn't understand concussion and didn't know what to do about it, and that was one of the key things that led to this guy's death, it became really important to me to kind of start talking about it and to start researching to really get to the bottom of it all.
Yeah, because I mean, it wasn't until we were preparing for this interview really that I thought about what I did and didn't know about concussion before this, because I feel like in my memory, it's always just you see it in movies or TV shows. If someone knocks their head, it's like, don't let them fall asleep. That's what I knew about concussions. And then Like, I had a friend who had one last probably almost 12 months ago, and she's only recently been able to, like, look at her phone for a sustained period of time or use her computer to work. And I didn't realize, like, that's even, you know, pretty mild compared to, like, ongoing repeated blows to the head. So what, for people like me, but also people like our listeners who maybe don't have a super, you know, deep understanding of it, what is a concussion and what happens to your brain when you get one?
So I'll caveat this with I'm not a doctor, and my research is entirely self-driven. So if you suspect you have a concussion, the first thing to do is to get a professional medical opinion. So, but my understanding is that there are about 60-something signs and symptoms of concussion. And one of the problems with it is really difficult to objectively diagnose. So that's partly because of the symptoms are so variable. Mm. But the way that it was explained to me by a neurologist was that essentially when you get when force is transmitted to your head, so you get knocked in the head, or it could be that your head doesn't actually like hit anything, but your body moves in such a jarring way that your brain moves. So your brain is kind of sitting inside its jelly sack inside your skull. Your skull is really hard, but your brain is really soft, and mm-hmm. the skull is really hard to protect the brain. But if you are subjected to force strong enough that your body moves in a sharp way, or your head moves in a sharp way, the brain can move inside your skull. And so what happens with a concussion is that it twists or tears the neurons. So there's injury, kind of very, very delicate. These very delicate things can be bruised and twisted. And the word that this neurologist used was sheared, which is quite a visceral word.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Just imagining your brain moving is so scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those injuries, like, they're physical things. That's a physical thing that happens to your brain. But the consequences of it, we often think of concussion as like a mental thing, like a cerebral in the sense that it's like a consciousness thing, not quite tangible.
Yeah.
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 But actually it's a physical injury that has consequences for your brain activity. So for me, when I sustained that concussion, so the hit that I got was not very hard. I wasn't wearing a helmet, but that actually doesn't make that much difference to whether you're going to get a concussion or not, because what's inside your head, not what's outside your head, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Did you know immediately that something had happened?
I knew that I had a sore head.
Right.
And I felt a bit kind of wonky. Mm-hmm. At the time, that's how I thought about it. I'm like, oh God, that was a hard one, you know.
Mm.
But it was like it was a left hand. There was a hook that hit me on the left-hand side of my face, on my jaw. And I've since noticed that whenever I have a very serious head knock, that's where I get hit, which is partly my own defense. But also, like, that's, I think, possibly once you've had one concussion, you're more likely to be hurt in those places. Like, you know, if you hurt your knee.
Yeah.
And then, like, the first place that you're going to be injured later is probably that same spot, because
If you suffer an ACL, for example, you're then more likely to have another ACL, even on the opposite knee.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yes, your body does that.
Yeah. So I felt wonky, and I had a sore head. And then on the train home, I couldn't quite get the words. I was talking to the friend who had actually hit me. I couldn't quite find the words to explain something completely innocuous, you know. Like, I just sort of felt like I was groping for something that wasn't there. And then I still had a sore head. I took some Panadol, went to bed, thought I'd be fine. The next morning, though, I woke up with a raging headache, and I felt like I was going to vomit. And I was just lying in bed. Like, that's what happened when I opened my eyes. At that point, even the night before, I knew I was concussed, but I didn't want to admit it. Mm. Because if I said, oh, I'm concussed, then I'd have to, like, go call work and say I can't come in for the next couple of days because someone punched me in the head last night. You know, it's like there's a social...
Hello, The Guardian.
I was going to say, says the deputy culture editor of The Guardian. Yeah.
You feel kind of stupid, and also, I mean, particularly, like, how... it feels like it's socially unacceptable to kind of... to reject your responsibilities as a consequence of, like, your own dumb sport.
Right? It's also a hassle. Like, you're like, yeah. Oh, God damn it, now I've got to, like, go to the doctor and, like, take time off work and look after myself.
Is the fact that it happened while you were boxing part of that too?
Absolutely.
Because it's like, I chose this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I chose to do this dangerous thing. Now I'm suffering the consequences.
And not just a dangerous thing. I think people would be the most dangerous thing, you know, the most likely. So... Sorry. So continue with what you were saying.
Well, yeah. So I ended up, I went to work. I felt like I had a hangover, like a really bad hangover. And I felt shit all day. And I basically started saying at that point, I think I'm concussed. But I was like, oh, I'm just going to go home. I'm going to go home. I didn't actually leave work until about 3:30 that afternoon. And I can't imagine the quality of work that I produced during that period. But I went to the, I actually went to the doctor almost kind of as an afterthought. I thought, oh, okay, I should, probably should, if this is going to go on for a long time and whatever. So I went and he shone a torch in my eyes and he's like, your pupils are dilated. Tell me what your other symptoms were. And I told him and he's like, you've got concussion. Go and get a brain scan. He's like, you probably won't. So concussion, the first thing to note is concussion doesn't actually show up on a CT scan. It doesn't show up on an MRI either.
So can I just stop you because I want to ask this question? There is a concussion test that is conducted in the AFL when someone is concussed.
Yeah.
Now, is that a uniform test across all sports or is it a uniform test across, you know, the medical industry?
There is best practice as far as I understand. So right. I don't know the exact that exact test, but there is best practice, like a concussion, pocket concussion toolkit, which often medical professionals will have ringside or not often ringside, but like but like field side,
yes.
That has a bunch of like sort of, it's like a checklist, you know, right. Like looking for symptoms like those things that I just described, but there's also a whole range of symptoms, as I mentioned, like I don't know, unsteadiness of walking, like you're not walking steadily. I can't think of the other symptoms off the top of my head, actually, but there's a whole lot of different ones. And slurring of your words, you can't remember what day it is. Unconsciousness is obviously, like, when you think about concussion, you don't have to be knocked unconscious to be concussed. Mm-hmm. That's one of the critical, like, misunderstandings, I think, in a lot of, in the general public, is that being concussed means you're knocked out, but you're not necessarily. You know, periods of amnesia, things like that. Those are all, they're more serious symptoms, but they're still possible symptoms. So there is best practice, right. Medical kind of a diagnosis, but it's not objective. So they can't look inside your head and say, yes, you have a brain injury, or yes, your brain is not responding as it was before. There's a lot of, you can pretty much have an educated guess based on dilated pupils and things like that. But yeah, it is quite difficult. There is a bit of an arms race at the moment to develop technology that means that they can assess you, assess your baseline, so what you're like before you go out onto the field or into the ring or whatever, and then if they think that you've got a head injury, assess you again and then have a comparison. And so if your brain activity is like reduced as a consequence, or like overstimulated or whatever as a consequence of what's just happened, they'll take you off the field. But that doesn't exist in I think there's clinical trials for some devices around that, but it doesn't exist in the public at the moment.
What are they looking for when you get sent for a brain scan? What are they looking for then?
So they're looking for like brain bleeds, basically. So concussion is not a brain bleed. Mm-hmm. It's damage to the brain, but it's not a brain bleed. So it doesn't show up in the same way that like Davy's injury, for example, like if, you know, massive swelling or anything like that, that will show up in a brain scan, but like, and bleeding, but a concussion won't. Mm. But so my doctor was like, well, you have to go and do it anyway, just in case there's something that we don't know about at this point, and which would, you know, impact how you will go back to training. And so I went and had this brain scan, and that what they found was not a brain bleed, but they thought they found calcium deposits in my brain.
Oh.
Which is kind of, calcium deposits don't just happen overnight, right? They take a long time and they're very rare. But that's what they thought they found. And so that kicked off this huge, long kind of assessment and investigation process that took, months and was very scary.
Wow.
When they told you that, how did you feel? And did you automatically go, well, I'm going to quit boxing?
I was terrified and I started crying when I first got, I called my partner and I was just like, what is this? I don't know what to do. And it did as a consequence, it didn't make me stop boxing, because one of the reasons that I started boxing or kept boxing after I started in the first place was because of that sort of adrenaline thing. Like the way I feel when I box, I do not feel when I play any other sport.
Mm.
And I think people who kind of commit to a sport, there's generally not, it's not just because they like it, it's because something like really pulls them to it, you know?
It's a
like,
feeling they don't get anywhere else.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, you think about the kind of discipline and effort it takes to do something, like to become as like to finesse your skills as much as it takes to become an AFL player, right? Mm. You have to love that. Like you really have to commit to that. And you can't do that unless there's something really driving you. And so one of the things that for me, like the way that I feel about boxing, I just can't ever quite let go of it, even though I have kind of gone through periods, particularly in the last couple of years, where I'm like, why? Why am I doing this?
Why am I like this?
Yeah. What am I getting anything out of this? And given what I now know about concussion and long-term brain injury as a consequence of head trauma, like, am I willing to take this risk? Like, these are realistic possibilities. I can't just say they don't exist. I know too much. But I keep kind of coming back to it because of that, because of the way I feel about it. So when I was diagnosed with, when they were investigating this potential anomaly in my brain, I thought, look, I don't know if I can get back into the ring. How am I? Like, I'm going to have panic attacks the minute I step in. You know, what am I going to do? And that didn't really subside. That hasn't really subsided ever. Like that, how I felt that fear. Still kind of comes back every now and then when I get into the boxing gym. And so my training has been very erratic ever since.
So I guess from here I would like to talk about where the conversation is around the connection between concussion and long-term brain disease, because you've just kind of touched on that. There's a ongoing debate, as it seems, particularly in big sport, about the link between concussion, repetitive head injury, and the increased risks of brain disease such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, MND, and obviously we've had the finding this week. What have you learnt about this in your time?
So there's three, I think there's three really important kind of parts of this debate. There's the debate about concussion, how to diagnose it, and what you should do as a consequence of a diagnosis. As a sports person, but also as like medical professionals who are responsible for sports people, or not just medical professionals, but also trainers and things. Like, how do you respond to that in a sports person who clearly wants to keep playing? Right, generally, a sports person will not want to get out of the ring unless they have to. Or the field.
This is an AFL podcast.
We can just use the ring.
the grassy ring.
Yeah. there's like the long-term consequences of concussion. So there can be really long-term consequences of specifically of concussion, and there we have had a bunch of football players recently kind of talking openly about that in a really I think laudable way, right? Mm. Like I can't remember their names now.
Well, we've got Paddy McCartan is the most recent
McCartan,
one.
That's the one I'm thinking
Liam
of.
Liam Picken, yeah.
Yeah, so I've got one of the quotes. Paddy McCartan came out recently because he's been placed on the St Kilda Football Club's long-term injury list, and some of the things that he said about it at the time, he said...
devastating.
Yeah, it really... Yeah. He described it, his most recent concussion having left him as a shell of a person. He said, I haven't been doing a whole lot of anything really, and that's probably been the hardest part. I've lost my footy identity a little bit, but then also my identity as a person. I can't do stuff. I can't go to the supermarket when it's busy. I can't go to a cafe with my girlfriend or drive my car.
So Brain Injury Australia talks about this phenomenon of the miserable minority, which is the people who are the minority of people who have a head injury and then a concussion and then have ongoing effects for months, sometimes years, sometimes they never resolve. And that's not very well understood. A lot of GPs don't really understand that. And it's very difficult if you don't have somebody who can recognise it really early and get you into like therapeutic treatment for that. So that's my understanding of Paddy McCartan and some of those guys, right? Like they've had multiple concussions, many of them, but what they're dealing with now is the long-term consequences of a particular hit. So there's the what you do after an initial concussion and how you kind of manage going back to get back into sport. So you've got to rest. The understanding that I have is that for most concussions, around 2 weeks, you need to not be playing sport.
Right.
You need to be away from anything that's going to give you another hit to the head. That's really important because your brain needs to rest and it needs to, like any kind of other injury, it needs to have time to kind of get back together.
Mm-hmm.
If you've still got symptoms after that, then you're going to need to look at long-term kind of rehabilitation. But if you don't, and my practice And my understanding from the currently understood best practice for just a run-of-the-mill concussion is you can start kind of getting back to training after 2 weeks. And that's kind of generally how if I do get a hit that I think might be kind of – that there's a bad hit, I might not have an official diagnosis of concussion, but if I get a bad hit now, what I will do is I might train a little bit, but I won't get anywhere near punches. No. So I'll do exercise, but I won't let anybody hit me in the head. Until those 2 weeks have passed, and then I'll sort of slowly move back into it. So there's the initial concussion, like run-of-the-mill concussion, then there's like long-term consequences of concussion, but then the other thing is long-term brain injury. Now, something like chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, one of the key things that has come out of not only the research into boxers, but also into NFL players hasn't been as much done around rugby players, but a lot of the initial research into CTE happened around boxers as well. So the first definitive study around CTE, which had about was run by Anne McKee at Boston University. Sorry.
Just before you go on, can you just describe what for people that don't know what CTE is?
Okay, so all right.
Oh, sorry, unless you were going to go there.
That's kind of what I was going to say.
Oh no, sorry. Carry on then.
Yeah. So one of the things that they found in these studies was that it's not just concussion that causes CTE down the track. So CTE is basically like very, very. This is a very much a layperson's description of it, and I'm not a neurologist, so or a neuroscientist. So please, talk to them for like definitive explanations.
Totally. Any concussion heads out there?
But it is like degeneration of the brain as a consequence of like very tiny, tiny injuries and like the deposit of proteins and things. So basically, it's hardening of different parts of your brain in a really microscopic way. And then it accumulates really slowly over the course of your life or over the course of your being punched in the head or hit or like impacts to the brain. And the critical thing about it, I think, is that it isn't just concussion that causes these proteins to kind of to be deposited in this, the hardening and all of the stuff that happens. It's subconcussive hits too. So it's like the scary part about it is you don't have to be hurt or feel hurt or have like immediate symptoms from hits for it to be damaging your brain in the long term.
So for like an AFL player, could it be just like you're in a really tough game and you're getting like a series of like really crunching tackles and you might hit your head on the ground sort of thing, but it's not enough to have you like taken off sort of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, that's the scary part. So one of the things about the NFL players who were found later to have had, and the boxers who were found later to have had CTE. And this is the other thing about it, you cannot diagnose it until after death because it requires like autopsy on your brain, basically. Whoa. It requires like cutting open your brain and putting it under a microscope to know for sure that that's what it is because it's about these like microscopic injuries. I hope I'm describing this correctly.
That's like the scariest part of all of this, right? To make any kind of to make any change or like to try to change the rules or like the procedures after hits and knocks and stuff like that, to know if it's working,
yeah,
you have to wait decades or wait till someone's dead. And then how long have those rules been in place then before they check? You know, it's like. It's,
and this is really only the first generation of footballers around which this conversation has been had in any meaningful way.
Yeah. So, I mean, the NFL players who were found to have CTE, and there were so many of them. Like, the most recent research, I think there were hundreds
in
the most
recent research.
This is gridiron. So you think about how many tackles and knocks and not concussive hits but, like, hard blows those sports people endure every training session. So it's not just your actual game. It's your training sessions. It's your skills development. It's all of that. Mm. You have to undergo so much impact. And so each one of those can have an injury, like can cause injury in your brain because your brain is so delicate, and you might not know until 10 years later when you start having like seizures or memory loss and the memory loss is like one of those things that kind of comes on gradually, and you might just think it's a bad day, and then like 6 months later you're forgetting that you put the kettle on and whatever, and that's what we're seeing in a lot of, I think, I mean, obviously these have not been diagnosed, these people have not been diagnosed with CTE because they are still living, and obviously they have varying diagnoses, but the AFL players that we're seeing come forward now saying they're having seizures, saying they don't remember their own family, saying, you know, they have massive mood swings. Mood swings is another thing. Mm. So when punch drunk syndrome, so this disease we've known about since the 20s, the 1920s, like, It was first diagnosed in boxers, obviously, and some of the things that they saw were like slurring of the words, like limping, kind of like a odd gait. That was a very strange kind of manifestation of it. But that was one of the things, like people would drag one of their feet. Difficulty thinking, forgetfulness, but massive mood swings, alcoholism, gambling. So social kind of symptoms as well as.
So shift in very behavior. Personal,
yeah, really big shifts in behavior. So people will go from being very polite, kind, kind of family men. This is like kind of the way that Martland, who was the key researcher back then, described it, would then go on to become like womanizers and drunk, like abusive drunks, and you know, massive, like they'd gamble away their entire fortunes and things. And that's kind of terrifying as well, because you don't necessarily, like, when we see that sort of stuff happening in our communities, we look for a social cause of that, yeah. You know, not necessarily like a biological, physical, yeah.
So I read a really interesting piece in The Monthly by Wendy Carlisle, which was published in September 2018. It's titled The AFL's Concussion Problem, and in it she goes into quite a lot of detail, some of the kind of stuff that you've discussed today. And then no doubt you'll be discussing your book, but about the relationship between what they call big sport and the outcomes of concussions and the long-term issues that we're facing, like what you've just discussed with concussions. Where do you think sports organisations today, what do you think the relationship is right now between sports organisations today and the scientific research that has been uncovered?
I think the key driving factor in a lot of the discussions happening in big sport at the moment is fear. The first is fear for their players, right? They are really concerned that there may be that most of their a vast like a very large proportion of their players may be permanently damaged as a consequence of playing the sport that they're in. The second is like. It is fear of what that might mean for sporting corporations, for liability, for long-term management of injuries, and also for public perception of the sports. That's what I see, and I want to underscore that's a personal perspective on what is happening in multiple different sporting codes. But I think that there's a very big polarization in both the sporting community, but also in the scientific community around brain injury as a consequence of sport, like this sort of long-term, like cumulative brain injury that doesn't manifest while people are actually playing, but becomes an issue in the decades following their career. So there are a group of people who don't accept the science around chronic traumatic encephalopathy. They don't accept that concussions are as bad as, or that the long-term impacts of concussion are as bad as some scientists are saying. On the other hand, you have people like Anne McKee in the Boston University Brain Institute, and I can't remember the exact title of their organization, but they are kind of leading the research in a lot of this stuff, particularly around the NFL. And their findings are so compelling. Like, I can't read any of those papers and think, yeah, sport's fine. It's not going to hurt you. Yeah. And professional sport, like, think about how many times a week, just a week, that people who play professional sport, contact sport, undergo so much, like, impact. Like, I just, the trend line is going in the wrong direction. Mm. And I think there is real fear within big sport in general that what if they accept it. And then, you know, like, in the NFL, they have now started to accept it and, like, officials have come out and said, yes, people are they have suffered brain injury as a consequence of playing NFL. The AFL hasn't, as far as I know, done that.
Has that resulted in like people starting to like change processes or like management or anything like that? Do you know?
I don't know. about that as a consequence of this. It's still kind of early days. So yeah. they have so in the NFL they did put a bunch of money supposedly into research for this stuff, like the impact of concussions on long term function for former players. But a lot of that funding ended up not going towards research for NFL players at all. It went towards research for jockeys.
Okay, cool.
And then was removed from the pool. Like the pool was no longer available. It's very complicated politics involved, and there are people who dispute the research into CTE who have very high level, like neurologists as well as bureaucrats within those organisations who dispute the science. And so basically my perspective on it is, there's a lot of fear about what it means for sporting codes, what it means for, you know, everyday people who play those sports, and then, but also for professionals, what it means for the other thing that you have to remember with big sport is there's so much money invested in these sports. There's so much money, and the people who play these sports are in a way kind of commodities, right? Mm. So they are pushed to become as perfect a specimen as possible to play this particular sport. It's not about their health and well-being. Like that sport at that level is not about health. It's just not. Like,
unless it means getting them back on the field for the next game.
Yeah.
That they can sell tickets to.
It's like you become a machine for the sport. You only have to talk to people who've been out of the sport for a few years and to hear that, like, you know. So I have a friend who used to play AFL, and he used to tell me that his young daughter had started groaning every time she like leant down to pick up her toys because she heard her dad do that all the time. And he's not old. He's in his mid-30s.
Can I ask you, so here's a concept that I want to throw up, and it's more just I'd like to hear your opinion on it. We accept that physical damage, long-term physical damage to your body is part of being a professional sports person. Mm. So we accept that as a footballer, for example, you
hit 30 and it starts
Well, it's also kind of like the more damaged you are, like the more lauded you are as well as an AFL player almost.
Yeah, but even if we're not lauding it, we accept it, So we accept it, and most footballers will accept. They'll say to you, I understand that I'm not going to have the same knees as a 36-year-old that hasn't played professional AFL since they were, 16 years old. I understand that. And that's okay. So do you think that brain injury, as we get, will become an accepted long-term injury of contact sports, given what we are beginning to see is that there is no way you can avoid playing contact sport and getting some brain injury?
So my theory about this is that it used to be more acceptable than it is now to have brain injury.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't really have hard data for this, but I imagine that if you think about boxers, for example, and the people who used to fight back in the early days of boxing in England, they were generally working class people. They were generally like known for their brawn rather than their brains. They didn't do things that required them to be hyper intelligent or they didn't make their living off their brains. They made their living off their ability to lift huge crates in the shipping yards, and there were butchers and Thamesmen and things like that. They would row boats down the Thames. They were the champions, right? So they were manual labourers essentially, or involved in very, very physical trades. But these days we almost exclude, like everybody needs to know how to use a computer. Everybody has like phones. Everybody like there's a push towards labour has developed in a way that means we're seeing much more kind of white collar labour than we see blue collar labour. We're required to be able to do multiple things at once in a way that we never used to be able to. Our attention spans are completely different to how they used to be. I think that our brains are valued in a way that they never used to be. Mm. Or not that they never used to be, but that perhaps once upon a time they weren't, as like everybody's brain wasn't as valued as it is now, and or as essential to making a living as it is now. Mm-hmm. And that it's actually that we're not going to see an acceptance of long-term brain injury we're not going to see that that's okay in professional sport.
It's also related to something that we speak about a lot, which is a growing awareness of and appreciation for like emotional intelligence in men. And when the vast majority of people playing professional sport and getting these kinds of injuries are men, and people care a whole lot more if men later in their lives have, become more aggressive or become like less reliable or dependable in terms of their families, you know, like that's those examples you were giving before. It's like if playing a sport is making men worse in, you know, to put it, be really blunt about it later on in life, that's completely unacceptable to like what sporting codes are trying to do right now to shift the narrative around their culture.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yes, I think that's right. I think the less that traditional masculine gender role is central to male identity, then the more unacceptable that kind of behaviour is, I agree.
Mm.
So just back to like, so Liam Picken, he was a Premiership Bulldogs player, and in, was it 2018, he suffered a knock, I think it was in a JLT match, so it wasn't even like in the season proper, but it resulted in him being quite concussed, which then started his whole journey of sort of trying to get back to the game that he obviously loved. His partner, Uncanny Annie, she's a podcaster, writer, big fangirls if you're listening, hi Annie. She's kind of written vaguely about watching his recovery and how tough that is to sort of watch someone you love, I guess, go through that whole process. Is that something that you have seen a bit in your research of sort of like the family impacts of watching someone with a concussion like try to sort of build themselves back up?
Not directly, although you could talk to my partner about what it's like to to have somebody who has multiple concussions then go back into the ring. I mean, so my personal experience of that is that my partner was perpetually worried and would occasionally sort of sit me down and be like, do you still want to do this? Like, do you, you know, maybe you need to make a decision about whether you're going to continue boxing or not, and maybe rather than just letting it kind of roll along, make it like sit down and decide. And that I think is hard because you, I think as a partner of somebody who's a sports person or who's into a particular kind of sport that you think is risky and dangerous, you don't want to tell them what to do, but you also can't stop worrying about them.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think the other thing about brain injury is often it's invisible. So you, as a partner of somebody who's experienced one, and I suspect this is probably part of the difficulty, like that, Annie was sort of expressing, and obviously I don't know her personal circumstances, but my presumption would be that you don't necessarily know exactly how to help because you don't know what it is that they're exactly struggling with at that point.
Yeah.
So they're dealing with all of these kind of non-physical, well, things that you can't see them, but they need your support and being there for that kind of. It must be a very confusing time and a very, very disorienting time, not just for the person who's experiencing concussion symptoms, but also for the people surrounding them.
Mm.
I have a lot of sympathy for that. I think it must be really hard.
Even things that just lead to like general frustrations that you don't have the vocabulary for, like things like, I'm having increased light sensitivity and it's making me really tetchy and I don't want to look at anyone. Like, you know, that's the kind of thing that you're not going to just be like, how are you feeling today? Oh, increased light sensitivity and, you know, also, a short temper.
It would be really easy to take that personally, right? As somebody who's, you know, dealing with, like, someone who's constantly tetchy about whatever and they can't express what it is. Mm. Like, if you've got an open – if your brain is fine and you're able to express yourself in an articulate way, you could say, yeah, I have increased light sensitivity today. Yeah. But if you can't and if you don't really know what which weird symptom it is that's going to make you, putting you on edge, you end up fighting with your partner, you end up kind of having – there's all these social repercussions from this invisible physical thing.
Yeah. God, it's so scary.
But isn't it interesting? I mean, this is more a comment than anything, but, you know, you saying that, Amy, this conversation around concussion has changed so fast in a period of almost 24 months. It feels like 2 years. I think two years ago you wouldn't have heard Liam Picken, a player like Liam Picken himself or Paddy McCartan, talk in the way that they did about these injuries. You wouldn't hear a player's partner come out and talk about those side effects in such an affecting and openly emotional way. So there does seem to be a general consensus around taking these injuries almost more seriously than any other injury you can get in the AFL right now.
Yeah, I think that is the players responding to like the what they see as danger signs.
Yeah.
Mm.
If I were a professional sports person and I kept hearing that my sport might be giving me massive brain injuries, I'd be like, well, maybe I should stop.
Yeah.
I don't want to be a test case.
No, exactly. Yeah. I don't want to be the one that ends up like splashed across the headlines for. So there's actually something else that I want to talk about with regards to head injury, if that's okay.
Please, absolutely.
This is also highly contested in the scientific community, but also because the scientific community, when it comes to concussion research and the sporting community overlaps a lot, it's often very difficult to kind of figure out where the lines are. But anyway, so there is – when I was researching my book, I spoke to Alan Pierce, who is a researcher who was one of the interviewees in the Wendy Carlisle article, but he actually spoke to me before that article was published and talked to a lot of the things that he spoke about in that. But he was telling me about, partly as a consequence of me talking about Davy Brown, my boxer who died, but he was telling me about one of the biggest dangers of people who get concussed is that they will, within a few weeks of that initial injury, receive a second concussion, and that receive a second head injury, and that a consequence of the stress that their brain is already under from the first injury can have catastrophic effect when the second injury happens. So it's called second impact syndrome, and it's terribly scary for anybody who is in contact sport, because most of the time that people have been diagnosed with second impact syndrome, it's because they're dead.
Oh my God.
So it's a consequence of that second impact being like massively over, almost like it's kind of, it has, your brain is already under so much stress that it just freaks out and swells dramatically and yeah, it's terrifying.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
So one of the really, really important things for concussion management for sports people is that they do not get back into a position where they can be hit again within a period of, like a specified period of time. And it's sort of a little bit.
So it's the quick succession that does it? It's the quick succession that does it, or is it the just the second
big
impact?
So there, when you say quick succession, it can be days or weeks later.
Right.
Right. So there is a very famous case of a girl in Canada who she was in her last year of high school, and she was a rugby player and she was captain of the team. Rowan Stringer was her name. And she went out on the field apparently like any other normal day. And she was tackled and she hit her head on the ground. And she kind of sat up and was kind of disoriented for a second, and then she passed out. Now she was treated by first aid people at the scene. She was taken to hospital really quickly. They operated to try and relieve the swelling on her brain, which was like massive swelling on her brain as a consequence of this hit, but they couldn't save her. Later in the inquest into her death, it was discovered partly through text messages that she'd sent to her friends that 3 days prior and 5 days prior, she had been hit in the head in training. And she thought she had concussion.
Oh my god!
And she had Googled concussion symptoms, and she was like, "Nah, I'm going to get back out. The only way I'll stop getting, and this is a paraphrase, but the only way they'll stop me getting out onto the field tomorrow is if I'm dead." As a consequence of that, the coroner recommended sweeping education for students, for, you know, sports people, but also for communities about what concussion looks like, how to recognize it, and what you need to do. One of the reasons this is controversial is because people say, well, you don't know that it was the previous, that there wasn't, that there was a previous hit that caused the initial damage that then was later exacerbated by the second hit. But the problem with concussion is it's so underreported. People don't know how to diagnose it in themselves. Well, obviously, they shouldn't diagnose it in themselves. They should go to a GP, but they don't know how to recognise the symptoms in themselves, and they feel shame about actually saying they have it.
Well, you don't want to go to the GP for a headache is one of the things too.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Mm. So there's a real social responsibility here, I think, to kind of change the way we talk about head injury and change our awareness about it in our sporting communities more generally, and to educate people for a start. Like, that's the first thing. But also to change, I think, and it does tap into what you were sort of saying about what we were saying about, like, masculine identity, right? That idea that you just kind of crack on. You don't say, I feel a bit wonky in my brain. Like, you sort of say, oh, no, I'm right. I'll keep going.
I have a bit of a headache.
Yeah.
I don't want to say that.
You don't want to say that. I'm going to not go out onto the field in this, like, extremely important match for my team because I have a bit of a headache.
Yeah.
But we need to be able to say that. I mean, it needs to be an acceptable thing to say in those circumstances, because it can be really dangerous. And so there are people in big sport, for, you know, shorthand, that do not accept that second impact syndrome is a thing.
Right.
They don't accept that it's a real phenomenon. I think that is a very irresponsible way to proceed on this issue.
It's not worth the risk.
Well, that's the thing. You think if there was even a chance that it is something that can occur, that would be enough when you're talking about life or death.
Yeah. So, I mean, that knowledge...
It's like climate denial. It's like, what if you're wrong, though?
Yeah. What if you're wrong?
All right. People die. Yeah.
You give it a name that you're comfortable with, the result is still the same.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one of the key... For me, that's one of the key reasons. Whether you think it's real or you think it's probably not, I feel like it's the kind of thing you shouldn't take a chance on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that always keeps me out of the ring when I have some kind of head injury. I'm like, or I think I have a head injury. I'm like, I'm just not going to risk that.
Oh, you know what, Steph, though? We've just spoken to you. We're nearly at an hour. We're talking to you about concussion. I can't believe you still step into the ring. And I don't mean that in a way that's – I don't mean that – I mean –
what it requires,
and it also speaks so strongly for the same reason that we hear these stories. Yet we know that footballers go out week after week. We know they still go in hard for the ball. Mm. We know they do all those things that can lead to a head injury. I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but just that it's quite extraordinary that passion and that will and how you can have all this information, but still, I guess, put yourself out there like that.
Well, we do have a very human beings have a very we're very talented at compartmentalizing as well, you know.
Yeah.
And in order to, I think the single-minded focus that you need in order to play sport helps a lot with, I'm going to say helps. I mean, I don't necessarily know if it's a good thing, but I think that does contribute towards people's ability to continue to go out onto the field every day despite their fears about this stuff, you know.
Mm. And I think that's why we like watching it as well. Like, even if you're not someone that participates, you're like, oh, wow.
Someone who holds
cool
back or doesn't completely, like, put their body on the line, to use kind of a crass phrase at this point.
Yeah.
But
it's true. But think about how much. So there was this bump by one of our players this year, Sydney Stack. It was an extraordinary bump. The player had to be taken off the field.
It was a classic hip and shoulder, as they said.
I want it played at my funeral. It was that good.
But this is what I mean. Like, we talked about that action, which is inherently a very... And I'm not making any implications in this. I'm just saying that was a bump and we loved it.
Well,
the
player who he bumped didn't play the next week.
Right, and I don't want to say that we're not implying there was anything in that or that there are any consequences from it, but the way in which we responded to that was with such joy and vigour. We were retweeting it. We're like, let's watch this bump again and again. It was the news of the week. So we still do, in our sport, celebrate these great moments of kind of effectively violence. When I say violence, but, you know.
Extreme contact.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I will ever be able to, you know, turn that off.
And we compartmentalize in the sense that if someone uses a fist, we're anti.
Exactly.
But if they use a hip and shoulder and a player's knocked on the ground and then pulled off the field, we think it looks cool and it's exciting.
Then, it's part of the game.
Or you look back to, like, my granddad's days of playing, and, like, they did use fists. They did elbow players to the head and there was no consequences. And now they're the sorts of people that look at AFL today and sort of go, oh, well, it's too soft. They're not hard enough.
Mm.
It's like, crazy to me.
You see this in boxing, right? Like people cheer for a knockout. They're cheering somebody being knocked unconscious.
Yeah.
It's a very muddy space to kind of wade into, but it is tapping into something I think that is very it's very contentious, but it's also very human.
Yes.
And scary for that reason, I think.
Mm.
So, Steph, you did a little plug at the top, but for people who are listening to this and would like to read more of your work that's already out there but then read your book later on, give us a little plug of where people can find you.
So I'm the Deputy Culture Editor at Guardian Australia, so you can find my work there. I mostly write about the arts there, but I have written about boxing occasionally.
Which is an art.
It is an art. But my book about what happened to boxer Davy Brown and also my own experience with boxing is called Who Killed Davy Brown, and it will be out through Penguin in March.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can give it a rating on Apple Podcasts. If you're not subscribed already or your friends and family members aren't, tell them to, and also do it yourself. Our socials and email address, if you want to get in touch, are all linked in the description box below. Our theme music is by Wet Lips and our artwork is by Steph Hughes. And we'll see you next time.
Full credit to the girls.
Full credit to the girls.
Say hi to your dad for me.